Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news, and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.
Hello and welcome to the Fulham Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and I'm delighted to be joined by George Singer and Guy Barlow of Fulhamish in the studio. Evening, gents. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good.
Surviving. It was an odd weekend for you, presumably, because Fulham lost and that was exactly what you wanted to happen.
Yeah, it was, yeah. Well, it would have been better if Spurs had held on. But no, I mean, There were bigger things at play at the weekend of the protest, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But yeah, I mean, we never expect to get anything from the top six anyway. And if it can hamper Liverpool's title challenge, then I was all for it, to be honest.
It's weird that smiling going, yeah, it was a great weekend. We got battered. I'm so happy.
It was a really strange atmosphere at the game, to be honest, because I think both sets of fans, Fulham fans, knew we were going to lose. Even a victory would have meant very little to us. Man City knew from kind of what the fourth minute they got the lead, they knew they were going to win. So it was a really bizarre kind of flat atmosphere with, you know, really kind of passive sets of fans. It was a really bizarre game to be at.
Any Liverpool fans in the home end?
I don't think so. I'm not sure they'd want to watch their rival play. I mean, it was on TV as well. Well, they wouldn't need to be there.
They wouldn't. They wouldn't indeed. It's a game that was under focus from the City point of view because obviously they're still in the title race. It wasn't considered massive for Fulham in terms of avoiding relegation. Do you think the media and perhaps even the fan base themselves have accepted the fate of the club?
I think so at this point. I think definitely from our points, you know, we're literally one game away. If we lose tomorrow, we're mathematically relegated. I think we all knew it was coming from, you know, look back at kind of Burnley away. I think that was the point really where most of us thought, you know, it's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, Burnley away being, just so you know, Johnny, it was the second week in January, so it was like the 10th of January. So we knew back then that we were going down, really.
So you've had time to go through all seven stages of grief. We've done anger. In fact, most of it was before I was doing this show, so I've only got you at the acceptance point. So we're all very, very happy.
We accepted quite early on as well. Like, I mean, could even go back to Huddersfield away in like November.
Oh, come off it. You weren't looking at it in November going, we're down, are
No,
you?
But we knew that we were in serious trouble back then.
Right.
Like, we had a semi-positive start to the season, you know, got an early win under our belts against Burnley at home, and then some encouraging performances, particularly at Spurs at Wembley. But yeah, I mean, that for me was like, you know, this is looking bad now. And then Burnley was just the nail in the coffin.
So on the so cheery on the Fulham Fan Show. In terms of those encouraging performances, then was there anything about this performance that encouraged you looking ahead to next season? If we've accepted that you're going to be playing Championship football, is there anyone there, anything there that makes you go, you know what, it's not all bad?
So another man of the match performance for Anguissa. I thought he did pretty well. When you play in a midfield two with just Tom Kearney against Man City's midfield, you're always going to struggle. But I thought he was really comfortable on the ball compared to Tom Kearney. Tom was kind of misplacing passes the whole game, and Giesel was the ball just stuck to him really. He put himself about, and you know, if we keep him, hopefully during the summer, I think he's one of those players that's going to really help build a good solid foundation going forward.
Yeah, and it's encouraging the fact that there's a weird spin on it, admittedly, but because both of Man City's goals came from errors, so like surely we can't carry on in this way, you know. Like eventually something's going to change. Eventually we're going to stop giving the ball away and conceding goals because I believe we've made the most errors leading to goals in the league, and you know, like that's just unsustainable in any division, let alone the Premier League and against Man City.
Why do you think those errors happen, Guy? Because obviously the Fosu Mensah one, when he gives the ball away, there's nothing Premier League about the press from City, really. It's just a bad mistake. And yet we weren't seeing Fulham do that kind of thing so much in the Championship. So where's it suddenly come from?
Yeah, that's an interesting point as well, because of the way we played last year. And it was a philosophy point to make sure all our players were comfortable on the ball. And we weren't making those kind of mistakes. We were certainly risk-taking. And, you know, especially particularly our goalkeepers last season, Button and Bessinelli, were always doing things that made the fans uncomfortable. But I think that's just a lack of maybe a concentration. That's all it has to be, you know?
Yeah. And from our side as well, obviously last year we had Kevin McDonald, who played that anchorman role, and the ball just stuck to him. And any time, you know, our centre backs were under pressure, he was always there. He'd drop back, kind of drop into almost like a third centre back role. He was so comfortable on the ball. He had, you know, one of the most passes in the league last year, and he was, you know, you could always build something off of him.
Also, a proponent of housery, as we've heard on the show before.
Not as much as Stephanie Hansen.
Not as much as Johansson, but a bit of housery never goes amiss, of course. Do you think some of those errors might be psychological? Obviously, you're bang on about not having a holding man in there in the same way. But if Fulham were set up for a game in which they're expected to win, if we're talking about Barnsley at home as opposed to City, do you think the players are thinking, well, it's only Barnsley, so then there's more confidence to play and fewer errors?
Yeah, and when you're against a team like City, look at their first goal. Bernardo Silva's finish was, you know, from outside the box, under a bit of pressure. He had, you know, only a ball's width to hit it in, and he hit the target perfectly. And against a team like City, that's all they need. When we drop down to the Championship, you know, that level of quality just isn't going to be there. So, you know, it does take a bit of pressure off, because you know, if we do give the ball away and we reduce them to a shot outside the box, you know, 99% of the time it's not going to go in the Championship, because they just don't have the quality of players. But against a team like Man City, they can put it away.
In terms of the Silva goal, you said under a bit of pressure. Do you think he was under enough pressure? Because as I see it, there are two errors in that goal. Fosu-Mensah gives the ball away. It's shoddy, but, you know, it happens. Fine. But actually, there are a few players, not least Fosu-Mensah, around Bernardo Silva as he's on the edge of the box. And we know all about Silva. He's a tricky player. He shifts the ball onto that left very nicely. It's all very fluid. But could someone perhaps have closed him down faster or even got a foot in?
Yeah, I think Kearney was one of those people who could have closed him down quicker. We're talking about this off air, George. Kearney had a pretty poor game overall as well. I know we're going to talk about formation, but he was alone in there with Zambo. And, you know, I just don't think that he's the kind of player you want pressing, you know, and nor would he want to be himself personally, you know. But I think those errors, it just comes down to lack of concentration and the players just not being good enough at this level. Like, it's that simple. And we've known that for a long time. You know, we've known that our players aren't good enough. We've known that our defence isn't good enough. And through just, like, lack of experience or lack of form and lack of, you know, quality in Odoi, Rico's just lost his head. His form's gone off a cliff. Ream and Odoi were never cut out for the Premier League. And Fosu-Mensah is a young player. And Bryan's might be Premier League quality in a few years, but he's got no experience. So those three things have just meant that, particularly in defence, we just haven't had a prayer this season.
On the positives, though, Zambo is a ridiculously cool name. Imagine being called Zambo. I would just walk into a room and feel unbelievably cool every time I went anywhere. Zambo. Would you go by Zambo, guy?
Or Andre Frank Zambo Anguissa is his full name. Andre Frank Zambo Anguissa. That's the chant, I believe.
Maybe that's the secret. Fulham need more people with cool names next season, George.
I think so. Yeah. Christy, Ream, Odoi, not really cool.
It's not the same. Andre Frank Zambo Anguissa, that's what we want. Coming up, we'll be talking about the formation. Did Scott Parker get it right?
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to the Fulham Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio. As ever, we are keen to hear from you. You can get in touch on 0208 7020 558 or at Love Sport Radio on Twitter. Now, Scott Parker, still Fulham boss on paper in a sort of interim role. He's there as caretaker, that age-old term. We'll be discussing later on in the show whether that should become on a permanent basis. But in terms of the City game at the weekend, George, you've got some reservations about how he set the team up.
Yeah, exactly. So these, you know, these stretch of games for Parker, it's a job interview for him. You know, none of us were expecting him to keep us up. Really, it's his, you know, chance to really put his stamp on things and prove that he's the right man for the job. And what we want to see from that, we've mentioned before, kind of that pride and passion, and we're, you know, a bit of positivity and happiness coming back from the team. We're seeing bits from that, but from me, what I want to see is I want to see him making the right tactical decisions. And against teams in the Premier League, you've got, you know, every possible kind of team in the Premier League. This is where I want to see him start to adapt and line up Fulham in the right way to nullify the opposition. And it can be done. You know, we saw how Newcastle a couple of times have done it against some of the big guys. You know, it can be done.
Newcastle taking quite a lot of flack, though, for the way that they've set up against the top guys, particularly earlier in the season against Chelsea. The press really went for Benitez. As fans, if Fulham set up really, really negatively and got slated in the press, would that bother you? Or would you just be like, listen, this is a results business and we set the team up to get a result?
Yeah, at this level, definitely. I think if we did it in the Championship, maybe not. But and especially against the big teams, against the top six, like anything's a bonus, home or away.
Absolutely. Yeah. Our producer is a Newcastle fan and he's just got in my ear and said, we beat Man City, chill out. I think he needs to wind his neck in. if you were setting a team up to play Man City, how would you approach it? Because we've seen, obviously, Laurie Callis, producer and Newcastle fan, certain teams such as Newcastle set up to basically lock the game down and nick a lucky result that way. But we've also seen the likes of Wolverhampton Wanderers go, come on then, Pep, let's have a scrap, take the game to them and get something that way. So if you'd been in charge at the weekend, what sort of system would you have set up Fulham with?
The main thing I had the problem with was the back five. You know, I don't have a major issue with three centre backs. I know a lot of us were discussing when Ranieri stuck to it every single week. It wasn't always the right thing to do, but in the right circumstances, back three, back five, that can work. But against a team like Man City, firstly, they've only got one out-and-out striker in Aguero. You know, you don't need three centre-backs against Aguero. That's a waste of a man.
You arguably need 11 against Aguero, or perhaps 10, well, keep the keeper.
Yeah, and he did score as well. Found a little pocket of space.
Thanks to an error, though.
Maybe. But for me, it's the wing-back's role, because they're, in this setup, they were the only guys showing any kind of width. So they were the only real attacking focal point. And when Man City play with wide wingers and fullbacks that push on forward, that's two against one there. And we saw it time and time again of how, you know, City could push forward. They put pressure on Bryan, who made a couple of mistakes, and a few times going forward, because they were only running against, you know, one guy at the wing-back position who was just left isolated. You saw Kyle Walker's attack where he just sped from out of nowhere. He was able to do that because he was the free man. And that's what, you know, we've kind of moved around with this 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1, whatever. At least there you've got the wide midfielders who can come back and support your fullbacks and really, you know, put the, you know, if you can stop Man City's wide play, that's, you know, cuts out a huge amount of their attack. That's their dangerous people, are Sterling and Sané, etc. So it, to me, it felt really strange that he went with that back five, the strange midfield two of Van Gieser and Kearney. You know, Kearney, I don't get what Parker's doing. He's been here for a few seasons. He surely must know that Kearney's not a midfield two kind of guy.
Yeah, I think there are quite a few caveats to, you know, his selection this week. And one, Mitrovic is injured. But you're right in the whole five at the back. Like, the majority of our success in the past 2 years has come playing a 4-3-3. And we had Leroy Rossini on the show like a few months ago. And he put it quite simply in that, like, if your defence is your weakest position, there's no point just overcrowding it, because if you've got better attacking players than you do defensive players, then you play more attacking players and you play to your strengths, you know? And there is definitely something to be said for
that. I think you bang on, but do you think that's a realistic thing to try against City? Because if you played really attacking, you'd probably just get taken apart, wouldn't you?
Well, again, the other caveat is that it is City, but it's a free hit, you know? Like, in it works both ways. You can try playing defensive or you can try playing attacking. Obviously, that is difficult without our main focal point. And it was shown again, well, not again, shown for probably the first time this season. We've been very lucky with Mitrovic's injuries, because goodness knows how much worse we would be without him, if that's even possible. But, you know, like, we set up in a way, we play Babel up front, five at the back. I mean, personally, I'm not a fan of Christie as it is.
Just as a man.
Yeah. Well, he was playing right wing.
Hybrid role.
I don't know. Like, I would, in theory as well, like, Joe Bryan can play there, because we saw him, like, League Cup last season against Man U, like, bang him in. Like, he played left wing in that game and he was brilliant. So he's got it in him. Like, he was a goal scoring left sided player in the Championship, and he's still young. He in theory, he can learn, and he should be learning at this level. But it's just disappointing. We've tried flat five at the back a few times in the Championship as well. One particular game, I remember when it wasn't going well, we were on a poor run. We tried it away at Reading. I don't know if you remember that game. and Fredericks was the right wing back, obviously, and nearly got sent off, which was awful. I think we lost 1-0. Chris Martin missed a penalty. It was a rearranged game. But I don't know. I know we've had a whole influx of new players since then, and the playing style might have changed significantly, but I still don't think, you call it philosophy, you call it whatever, these players are not built to play five at the back, and they haven't been signed to play five at the back, and it's not their preferred positions, and it's just not the way that we need to be playing right now.
With that, it's interesting that you said, listen, Parker's been at the club for a few years, surely he knows what kind of player Kearney is. Picking up on what you said, Guy, about this squad isn't set up for a five at the back, does that concern you from the Parker point of view more broadly, in the sense that he perhaps hasn't quite got his head around what this squad is designed to do?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like I've said it before, you know, this is the interview and it feels like another strike against the guy. You know, if the benefit of going with someone like Parker rather than an outside hire, whatever you'd call it, would be that he's supposed to know, you know, people's strengths, know their weaknesses. You don't need that bedding in time. He's already, you know, semi-aligned with the philosophy, and you'd hope that he could give that kind of immediate benefit where an outside hire might take a little bit longer to do. And, you know, if he's putting players in strange positions, if he's picking an overall system which the player's clearly uncomfortable with, and playing, you know, this kind of really quite weak and fluid front three,
tell us what you really think, George.
they were terrible, the front three. Like nothing stuck to them at all. Babel isn't a striker. He can't play. I know we don't have any other options.
It's so difficult though, because like another thing is that we don't know how many of these players are going to be there next year. You know, like so many of them might leave, and Parker doesn't know what he's working with, and he's also playing Man City. Like he's had four games in charge, three of them have been against top six, one has been away at Leicester, and Brendan Rodgers' first game. Like, we need to start judging him now on tomorrow night and at home to Everton at the weekends, and then see what he's like, because those are the games that we might have reasonably expected to get something from at the beginning of the season. Obviously a lot's changed since then, and the squad's proven not good enough, but we need to judge him on these games coming up, and that's the message he's trying to be getting across as well.
We'll be having more on Scott Parker in just a moment. Before that, we've had a tweet into the show from a certain Mr. Dom Betts, himself of Fulhamish and a regular on the show. Dom, the reason why Dom isn't here and won't be here for a few weeks, of course, is because he's on holiday. He's a lady of leisure and he's on his way off to Hong Kong. He's tweeted in and said, not on the show tonight, but listening to the chaps in the lounge before my flight. Weird flex, but okay. If you'd like to get in touch like Dom, it's at Love Sport Radio on Twitter or 0208 720 558.
This is Love Sport.
You're listening to the Fulham Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and George Singer and Guy Barlow of the Fulhamish podcast. It is the Fulham Show, but of course we have Premier League football for you tonight. Arsenal will be taking on Newcastle. We'll have updates for you throughout that game, and the team news is in. There's bit of interesting tactical tinkering from Unai Emery. For Arsenal, it's Leno in net, Mustafi, Socrates, Monreal and Maitland-Niles at the back, Ramsey, Guendouzi and Ertzel in midfield, with Kolasinac, of course, as a left wing back, and Iwobi and Lacazette coming up top in that three with Ertzel, so no space for Aubameyang in the starting lineup. And for Newcastle, it is Dubravka in net, Yedlin, Lejeune, Lascelles and Dummett at the back, Richie, Perez, Diame, Hayden, Almiron and Rondon. So quite a bold attacking team from Newcastle, not the kind of defensive setup that we saw them get criticised for and my producer get upset about. Now on to Scott Parker. And a phrase that we've heard from George Singer a lot in this show is the interview. He's in a job interview. That's what Scott Parker has at the moment. It's a job interview. So we're going to look at this hypothetically, gents. It is a job interview. You are sitting behind a panelled mahogany desk and Scott Parker's just walked in. He's got a suit on. He's got his tie done up nicely. He's wearing Vans because he's got something slightly wrong in the style department, but we'll move beyond that.
That's impossible, actually. He looks like an RAF pilot, doesn't he?
So hang on, we've got to dwell on this
yeah.
now. So Scott Parker, I agree with you that he does look like he's straight out of the 1930s, but do you think his dress sense is particularly exceptional?
Yeah, 100%. He's got advisors around him.
He's got advisors around him. Sartorial advisors.
Yeah, he knows what to wear and when, you know. He's a smart man. Yeah.
So no Vans with the suit. He's actually wearing...
You couldn't see Parker wearing Vans, could you?
No, definitely not.
No.
Okay, so what? Brogues, I apologize.
Perfectly
Brogues?
Shined Brogues. Yeah, yeah.
No, bespoke Italian leather, I reckon.
Okay, an Oxford, a Derby.
I'm not sure I can remember the difference, but
basically the same thing. I don't think anybody really knows.
Yeah, yeah.
He's got a chief, a handkerchief in.
He's got a handkerchief. Okay, yeah. What suit? What colour is the handkerchief?
Oh, blue.
Definitely blue suit. What colour of handkerchief?
Red. No, black and white.
Black and white. It emerges that the advisors who Scott Parker's got around him are in fact Guy Barlow and Guy Barlow only, which is why he's
he doesn't need me anymore. He's got it.
It's why he's perfectly dressed. But we've established he's wearing a lovely blue suit with a black and white handkerchief as in the pocket. But if you're sitting behind that desk and you're the people conducting the interview, what are the questions you're asking him? Beyond what's your biggest weakness, because you're not allowed to ask.
I'm not
that.
Sure I'd even give him an interview.
You wouldn't?
If I'm completely
You'd
honest.
You'd lock the door.
Yeah, I don't really... I'm not sure I'd like him, to be honest. I mean, caretaker managers rarely work out long term. Can you name me one? Either of you? Because Darren Moore was like the one that everyone was going on at West Brom this year, but then he got sacked.
He got sacked quite unfairly, to
but
be
then,
fair.
But now West Brom have bounced back, and the board have been proven in their to be correct in that decision.
True.
But
John Carver was, of course, the best manager in the Premier League,
of course,
famously.
And he kept them up, and Rafa Benitez didn't. But let's not remember that, shall we? But anyway, yeah. I mean, caretakers, that's my main point, really. Caretakers rarely work out, and it'd be interesting to see what the board do. I think my preference would be someone like David Wagner coming in, someone who knows the Championship. I know that's not an absolute necessity these days, because not lots of managers have come in and done it. But, I don't think we should be considering him Scott Parker full-time.
Yeah, my only caveat with someone like Wagner would be, yeah, he got Huddersfield promoted, but on a negative goal difference. Like, there was something... There's surely a little
promotion
bit of
is promotion at... is promotion. Like, who cares?
Well, with that in mind, then get Steve Bruce in.
Oh, yeah, he's got a job at Sheffield Wednesday.
Steve
now.
McLaren's going.
Yeah, he's now...
No.
Did you have him?
I think I'd rather my
he
managers...
He would be wearing Vans.
and I don't know. No, I'd rather my managers not have a weird little island on the top of their head, you know.
And a rubbish umbrella.
umbrella, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. No to Steve McLaren, but it needs to be someone who like is willing to buy into the head coach setup and someone who's willing to play like or at least attempt to play decent football. Because I think George and I are on the same page here. Like I'm not willing to accept a Sam Allardyce.
Jovanovic.
I don't
available.
Know. Like, yeah, he's available. Arguably, he can move on to bigger and better things than us now. Like,
do you think
know.
He'd come back?
No.
He's still on the payroll, isn't he? Because we sacked
is
him.
He? Is well, he still on gardening leave or something?
No, that's how it works, isn't it, in football? Like
I thought you got paid off in a bulk sum.
I think they keep you on the payroll and pay you every week because it's too expensive to pay you off in the bulk sum.
Ah, interesting.
Okay. Because that's how Leo Jardim was able to go back in at Monaco.
I see. There was talking of Monaco. There were reports today that Henri... How long was Henri in charge at Monaco? Sort of 3 months? Not very long.
Yeah.
He earned from the wages in that and the severance deal sort of 25 million euros, if reports in France Football are to be believed. So
he needs the money as well.
But, I mean, that's nice work if you can get it for 3 months.
Yeah.
In terms of Parker... How does that work if you don't give him the job permanently? Because he's been at the club for a while. He's a valued and respected member of the coaching staff. Do you think he'd be willing to take the suit off and go back to the backroom role and go, fine, I'm back on the training pitch? Or actually, does not giving him the job mean you lose him completely?
I think he's mentioned before he wants to go into management. I don't think he's happy to settle as a coach. He's worked his way up from, what was he, like youth? Was he youth manager at Spurs?
Yeah, he was under 18 manager at Spurs.
Under 18 manager. And he's worked his way up. He's got to, essentially, he was that kind of assistant manager role and now caretaker. I just don't think he would find it the right thing for his career. He's now got his name in the spotlight. I don't think, you know, he's not doing a terrible job. And more people are aware of him. I wouldn't be surprised if you're seeing... people like, you know, Frank Lampard getting jobs at Derby and Steven Gerrard getting jobs at Rangers. You know, he's not quite that kind of legend status, but I think he's in a similar mould where he could probably find a, you know, SPL or maybe a lower half championship team and work his way up from there. I think that could be possible for him.
Yeah, and he's brought in people around him as well that he trusts. He brought in his coach from the under-18s at Spurs. He brought back Stuart Gray, which is a very popular decision. We haven't... kind of seen the fruits of Stuart Gray's labour yet, in that we've still conceded two goals in every single game he's been in charge, at least two goals. But I think he's planning long term himself. He's probably putting players around him and starting. I know it's difficult, as I said before, he's don't know who's going to stay or go, but he's probably got in his mind who he wants to keep in the summer. I wouldn't be surprised if he's like drawing up transfer targets. And he has got the advantage of, especially in our like head coach model, he knows that model. And also because it'll be his first job, he hasn't known anything else, so he might buy into that more readily. I think there are points on both sides, but overall, like he needs to perform his last five games of the season, doesn't he? Like, he needs to get a couple wins, really. Because we should beat Cardiff at home. I mean, Newcastle at home, we're going to look at that, and Everton at home as well. Like, we've got these remaining games of the season. I want to win a few. You know, I was looking at our last relegations.
Those records. You don't want to take any off Derby.
The most goals conceded one, I'm happy to take. Okay. No, joking, I'm not. Yeah. I'm not at all. But no, I was looking at the last time we were relegated, and we won 9 times that season, and we've only won 4 times this season. So this is like so much worse, and it's weird. It doesn't feel a lot worse, but in on paper, it really, really is.
I think it's because Huddersfield are there, and yeah. They're always, oh, but there's always Huddersfield. They've been like our safety net, that at least they've always been below us, and they've been one of the worst, the second fastest team to get relegated?
Yeah, one of the only, second team to get relegated in what month did we just have? March. Yeah. Yeah. So, and the third team to get relegated with 6 games to go. Yeah. So that's pretty poor. And they still need to score 2 to like surpass Derby's record of like fewest goals scored in the season.
I think they will. I think Carlin Grant has got a couple more goals in him.
He was playing League One for the first half of the season.
He was, but he was really, really impressive at Charlton. And I must say, when they signed him, I was with you, Guy. I thought, that is a big leap, Carlin, if we're honest. But the second goal he scored against West Ham in particular, I think there's quality there. I think there are goals there. But in terms of Scott Parker, if he doesn't give the job, and it sounds pretty much agreed that neither of you want him on a permanent basis, who do you want? Talking of Huddersfield, are we looking at David Wagner as the number one option?
For me, it's the guy in the Man City dugout, and not Pep Guardiola as much as...
you could offer it.
Yeah, I don't think you take it. For me, it's Arteta. I'd love to have Mikel Arteta.
Why are you so keen on Arteta?
So he's learning from the best manager in the world. He's been working under him for a few years now.
He hasn't worked under Ranieri.
he's learning to play the right way. He's vocal. He knows the English leagues pretty well. He'd command respect. And also, again, we mentioned before about this whole head coach role, and we'd want someone to come in for all of Jokanovic's strengths. One of the issues we kept having is he wanted all this control over transfers, and we need for the next manager not to make the same mistake again of someone who's happy to give an input but realises that they're not the responsible person for all of it. And I think if you took in someone like Arteta, who's, you know, keen to prove himself, keen to step up to that role for the first time, he's exactly the kind of person who'd probably be happy to, you know, act in that kind of role.
I think it'd be a pretty big coup if we were to get him. I think he could probably go in at a higher level than us, you know. Because probably next year is going to be a very difficult season in the Championship. Either way you look at it, it's so hard to bounce back up straight away. And it's such a long slog in the Championship. It's 46 games. But I think he could do better himself, personally. That's no like slight on us. I think it's just being a bit realistic.
He would be very well dressed as well. But do you think...
No fans for him.
Do you think Arteta knows the Championship well enough? I mean, he didn't play there. He was obviously vastly experienced at Everton and then Arsenal. But it's sometimes a league, because the fixtures come thick and fast in the way that they do, it's more about knowing the division than it is being some kind of master tactician, isn't it?
So I think one thing on that, Man City have probably played as many games as we would in the Championship. They're going for titles. If you watch the All or Nothing piece, like there's a whole couple of episodes about how many matches they had to play and how Pep works around that. So I think, you know, he's definitely learnt about that from that piece. And, you know, I'm always a bit cautious about the whole knowing the league thing. I mean, Jokanovic got promoted without knowing the league. Wagner got promoted without knowing the league. Who's the Wolves guy? Forget his name.
Nuno Espirito Santo.
There you go. He got promoted without knowing the league. I guess, you know, for every one of those, you've got a Colin who also gets promoted. But I don't think it's the be all and end all having experience in the league, personally.
Well, it could be that Mikel Arteta is the man for the job. We just got some breaking news coming into the studio, which is that Everton are investigating a video which allegedly involves Jordan Pickford in a fight in Sunderland on Sunday night. It's obviously no confirmation whether that's true. I'm sure that the England goalkeeper denies those allegations, but we'll bring you more news from that as we get it.
This is Love Sport.
It's the Fulham Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio, where we will, of course, be bringing you updates of Arsenal versus Newcastle throughout the show once they kick off. Now, City, we know, are one of the strongest sides, if not the strongest side in the Premier Division, certainly in terms of strength in depth. And one thing about them is that they're so creative and they keep the ball so well that they can make football look very, very easy. And some people have been suggesting that actually they didn't really have to get out of first gear against Fulham.
They'd be absolutely correct.
Driving around at 12 miles an hour. Yep, beep, beep, 2-0, cheers.
And it's, especially with the goal after just 5 minutes, just kills the game, doesn't it? And then the second goal after 25, when it was, it's done in half an hour, and they didn't even have to work for their goals, because as we've said, they're both defensive mistakes. So yeah, this question, did they have to get our first gear? No.
Not even second. Didn't even get a little bit excited approaching a roundabout. Just full on first gear.
Maybe the Kyle Walker chance when he did a little bit of running in the second half.
Broke out of a jog.
Yeah,
for
but
a
maybe that's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, they're definitely the best team in the world. Probably one of the best sides we've ever seen in football, I'd say. I'd go as far as saying that. I thought they were just so comfortable on the ball. The way they pass it around, and you're always going to get that with Silva and De Bruyne in midfield. You know, they just cut us to pieces. And once they got that second goal, and this is what was so bizarre about the game, we were frankly rubbish. We were never going to score. I mean, the match could still be going on now and we still wouldn't have scored. Man City, the last thing they want to do is spend any more effort than they'd need. You know, they've got FA Cup, they've got Champions League. They're as much as, you know, we had a call in last week from a Man City fan who said they don't think the quadruple's going to happen. From my point of view, I think Pep's absolutely going for it, and he'd absolutely tell his players don't you know, use up an ounce more of energy than you need to. And they didn't have to. They could just pass it around and just kind of strangle the game slowly.
Yeah, why would you waste energy on Fulham? I mean, their bench as well was absolutely insane, wasn't it? Like,
yeah. Mahrez coming on.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, another thing is that a lot of those players are in top form, you know, particularly Sterling springs to mind.
He's a glorious footballer, isn't he? I mean, he's really, really fantastic. I was one of the people who was really critical of him over the summer at the World Cup, because obviously he wasn't scoring any goals at all. He was missing some chances. But this year in particular, he's gone up. He hasn't gone up a level. He's gone up about, what, three levels? He's been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, there's the I don't know, the with the whole Pep versus Mourinho debate, there was always the question of who improves players more, and for me, it's unquestionably Pep. Maybe if you look at the Sterling that he inherited, was it, I think Pellegrini signed Sterling, not him, but yeah, I mean, it's particularly this season, as you say, he's just added that kind of finishing to his game, and he's a quality player, and I'm very happy he's English.
Unquestionably Pep sounds like the name of an absolutely terrible City Twitter account, doesn't it?
Yeah, with him as the Avi, obviously.
With a terrible filter on it. I can actually see it now.
Yeah. Do you know Sterling nearly signed for Fulham?
Back in the day?
Yeah.
Is that before QPR or from QPR?
From QPR. He was in the training ground. He'd nearly signed the contract, and then Liverpool called up.
Why does that keep happening to Fulham? Because we heard rumours in January that various Chelsea players, including the likes of Gary Cahill and Victor Moses, were shown round the Fulham training ground and then decided that perhaps it wasn't for them.
Well, Gary Cahill, he's just happy to sit on 150 grand a week and not play. Like,
to be fair.
He can do what he wants. But I don't know. It's like we didn't sign Tammy Abraham, so we signed his brother Timmy. he's on our youth books. But yeah, I don't know. Like, but especially with academy players, like, we've got a reputation for it now. Like, why wouldn't you come and play for us? Like, it's proven path to the first team. It's an attractive place to come.
Yeah, and true. But then again, if Liverpool call, you're going to you're going to answer it, aren't you?
Yeah, and he did get into their team age 17 as well, like, and nearly helped them win the league.
He definitely made the right choice. And I think, you know, with all the news, well, all the stories from about him in, you know, papers like the Daily Mail or whatever, I think a lot of people have grown, you know, against that, a lot of sympathy for the guy, because they know he's been probably harshly, you know, he's been harshly criticised for stuff that he shouldn't have been done. And I think lots of people have this, you know, have this sympathy for him. And I think we're all really happy to see him do well. I mean, for the first time in a long time, you know, there's people are actually caring about the England squad and how we're doing. And I think he's a huge part of that.
Yeah, I've seen various people on Twitter, I think rightly, saying that actually that status of the kind of the golden boy of English football in the last couple of months in particular has started to transfer from Harry Kane, MBE, to Sterling, not because he's outscoring Kane or that he's a better player. They're, of course, very different players. But because Sterling has actually, as you say, George, in the face of serious adversity, shown himself to not just be dignified, but also eloquent and clever and also quite funny, and just takes everything in his stride, handles the ridiculousness. You know, there was that rumour that he had sort of 53 children by 75 different women, when actually he's just a totally normal family man with a totally normal amount of kids with one woman. And he just shrugs it all off and addresses the racial aspects of it intelligently and properly, and is just becoming a real delight and, dare I say it, cliche, but national treasure. He is, of course, a main man for City. You were saying how much depth they've got. Do you think that quadruple is realistic?
I think they might come unstuck, actually, at Spurs, perhaps. I think of the four or the three remaining trophies they're going for, I think Spurs in the Champions League is probably their most difficult one, I would maybe argue.
Mm. George?
It feels like kind of three coin flips to me. I mean, them and Liverpool, it's so close. I think City might just nick it again in the FA Cup. The only real opposition they've got there is Man United. You'd expect that they'd beat the other guys. Has the semi-final draw?
United are out, yeah. They've got Brighton in the semi and then Watford or Wolves in the final. So I think that's pretty sewn up.
I think Wolves knocked United out, of course. So Wolves
Liverpool.
And Liverpool, and they've taken more points off the top six than anyone else outside the top six so far this season. So not a pushover, but you would have to say that City are the favourites. Coming up, it was, of course, the massively important hashtag Stop the Greed protest on Saturday. But how did things go?
This is Love Sport.
It's the Fulham Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio. And Saturday was an important day for Fulham. It was an important day for Fulhamish because we saw the inaugural day, really, of the hashtag Stop the Greed protest. There were plans for banners, for pamphlets, for chanting, perhaps even for booing. But how did things go?
Yes, so this was the, I guess, the first kind of, you know, main focal point of the Stop the Greed protest that we've been kind of talking about and organising for, you know, a few weeks, like a month or so ago. The first kind of real airing of it was at the Man City games. So the plan for the day and what we did, obviously we had lots of banners created, which we initially hoped to bring into the stadium. Obviously, last time on the show, we spoke about how in the end we weren't able to do that. The club weren't happy with us doing that. They were more focused on, you know, letting Liverpool fans in than they were letting a fan-funded banner in. But there we go. So for anyone who was at the game or have seen some of the media reports that came out, we laid the banners out throughout the outside the stadium.
And how did that go? Did that get on the Sky Sports cameras or anything at any point?
So I think the not so much the show cameras. I think from a Sky point of view and also the Premier League show point of view, it was quite strange how some of the journalists were really kind of excited and taking pictures and getting involved in interviewing, and some of the more official areas, your Sky Sports, your Premier League show, were very cautious about taking any pictures or talking to any of us.
Well, I suppose they do have to be cautious, don't they? Because it is an expressly political activity, and so, or is football not political? Was this more simple than that?
Well, that's a whole can of worms about journalistic integrity, isn't it? About like where their loyalties lie. They shouldn't be influenced. Of course, they are by, you know, these huge corporations that, you know, from what George is saying, is like essentially making them stop, you know, fulfill a journalistic thing, which is like, you know, get a story.
Yeah, and you know, what incentive would they actually have to air the story? You know, you can sometimes, you know, you can kind of see where they're coming from, but for every you know, journalists like that, there were lots of people who were keen and were interested. So we had the banners go up before the game. We were having lots of conversation with fans. So as part of kind of the flyering and ticketing, we were trying to do was to, you know, reach out to fans, talk to them about what we planned on doing. We got loads of great feedback, and so many people were coming up to us and saying, you know, they thought it was a really excellent thing that we were doing. They were really behind it. They were really concerned about the club and what it was going to look like going forward. You know, we had, I think, on the Fulhamish website, Drew Heatley's just put a piece together. He's about to become a father himself, and you know, he's starting to think about the next generation. You know, I'm sure he's desperate for his child to become a Fulham fan. And if in the future the ticket prices keep going the way they are, then you know, it's that next generation of Fulham fans that are really going to suffer.
Yeah, and the consensus from, I think, the Fulhamish lads was that it was a success, and that there were things that might be done differently in the future. But overall, like, it's not the end of this, it's only the beginning. And I think that there are lots of positives, like you said, George, like people did get involved and get on board. And I look forward to it continuing, because to fight this, you know, kind of disastrous policy, which is pricing out fans and is ruining, you know, I don't know, an already ruined season, but it's just adding salt into the wounds, isn't it? And it is making it harder for future fans and current fans to get involved.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we were saying before, you know, none of us have ever done this kind of thing before, tried to organise this kind of protest. And I think, you know, in general, a load of, you know, blood, sweat and tears has gone into it. We're obviously, you know, so thankful for the fan funding piece that we did. So lots of people donated money so that we could go and do the things that we did on Saturday, which was great. So we had the banners, we had flyers, we got a chant going on the 55th minute. So, you know, I think the main plan for the day and, you know, the goal that we had was to make sure that as many people were aware, whether it be fans or journalists or, you know, fans from other clubs as well, were aware of what we were trying to do. And I think in that regards, we definitely succeeded. I think, you know, the hashtag spread pretty well. And I think, you know, hopefully I think like Guy said, this isn't just a one-off. This is a thing that's going to keep going. And hopefully the club are going to start listening.
Have you had any kind of official response from the club in the form of a statement or any contact at all?
Nothing at this point.
Do you think they're worried about it? Do you think they've registered that what's going on, but they're just not willing to give a public response?
So this is something we've brought up many times. So before the Stop the Greed movement started in the Fulham Supporters Trust, it had been brought up month after month after month. And there was an official response, which was that, you know, we planned for these ticket prices. It's very difficult to make any changes. However, this was the plan that we were going with and we were going to stick by it. So from all of the official response we got from the club, from the Fulham Supporters Trust side, suggested that there wasn't going to be any change. And I think after this movement, you know, hopefully we've shown the club now that they do have to make a change.
Yeah, and this project is very much long term. And we're thinking about the future generations of the club a lot more, arguably, than the actual club is, you know, because they're, as we've said many times before, they're thinking about this one season, what is ultimately one season in the Premier League that we're going to have, as cashing in as much as possible. And this pricing policy is not beneficial to anyone. You know, I mean, some season ticket holders I've seen have said, well, if it subsidises our season tickets, makes them cheaper, then that's just, then that's fine by me. But, you know, like, not everyone can afford a season ticket at a certain amount of time. And, you know, like, even things like the season ticket price went up by £200 minimum as soon as promotion was confirmed. So that's literally, you know, pre-playoff final and post-playoff final, like, season ticket went up. And that's just, like, it's just opportunism, isn't it? You know? And that this is what it smacks of, just, like, crude, you know, opportunism to try and make a quick buck. And it has, you know, put fans off this season on top of what's going on the pitch, and it might put fans off in the future, which is not what we need at our kind of club.
Well, yeah. Talking of crude opportunism, we've seen Sammy James, who is the host and founder of Fulhamish, tweeting today, disappointed that a small minority of people are accusing Fulham of, well, exactly that, of using hashtag Stop the Greed as some sort of branding exercise, as we dared to put our logo on a flyer. There are much, much easier ways to gain a few followers than to start a protest. So obviously, some people are viewing you as the opportunist, saying, listen, they're jumping on a bandwagon of fan concern and using it to promote their own profile. Do you think that's fair?
Well, I was going to say very quickly, George, as you said, like, this was brought up month after month in Supporters Trust, and ultimately something had to be done by someone, and Fulhamish have stepped in. We've got like this influence, we're using it for good, you know, like, and it was the right thing to do regardless of the brand.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, from our point of view, you know, we'd seen all those conversations between the club and the Fulham Supporters Trust, and it's, as a fan, it's so easy to get frustrated where the trusts are doing everything that they can, and, you know, using all their influence and struggling to make progress. And that's where, you know, someone like the Supporters Trust, because they've got this official setup with the club, you know, they can't necessarily do that piece that we did. However, what we can do, because we're an independent organisation, you know, we're not linked to the club in any way, we're able to kind of push some of those buttons in a different way. I think as Sammy said, you know, the main push of what we were trying to do was to use those banners. You know, there's no branding on any of those banners. It was never meant to be a Fulhamish thing. I think we saw from all the different, you know, Fulham fan sites out there, we had articles written on Fulham Focus, we had articles written on Hammy End, we had, you know, Fulham fans from around the world get involved and push this. And yeah, you know, we were definitely the main people pushing it, but certainly from my point of view, it didn't feel like it was a Fulhamish protest. It felt like it was a Fulham fans protest.
And it's not as if we're making any money from it either. You know, like the guys were getting there at 9:30 in the morning, and even earlier, to put up these banners and giving them huge amounts of their time, quite selflessly, like we said, to help prices come down for future fans. And they're thinking about the future, and, you know, more so than the club.
Yeah.
Worth noting as well that what lots of people have been saying is that despite the single tickets being quite expensive relative to the Premier League, Fulham season ticket prices aren't all that bad, and given most of the Fulhamish guys are season ticket holders, it is actually a fairly selfless thing to do. And I think actually it comes down to that point you made about the banners, that the banners were the thing that were there to get the attention, and they didn't have Fulhamish on them anywhere.
Absolutely. And I think, to be honest, when you do something like this, we were very much in the public limelight, we're pushing it hard, we're trying to get the message out there. And for, you know, every time you're in the limelight, 99% of people, especially for a cause that, you know, I think anyone rationally would think it's a good cause, trying to make football more accessible for more people, you're always going to get those 1% of fans who take, you know, have a problem with it for no real reason, and just they like to poke holes and like to make a problem with it. And I think, you know, that's all it is really from my side. I think from the majority of people that we spoke to, you know, we had so many positive messages coming through. You know, 99% of people were lovely and really happy about what we did. You know, you're always going to get those people trying to pick holes in it. But I think we've been pretty clear that we've tried to do the right things for Fulham fans here, not ourselves.
Yeah, and it's just the beginning. It is just the beginning. We're going to talk about what's happening next. But, you know, like,
sounding dangerously like Nigel Farage. If it's 48-52, it'll be unfinished business.
Well, it is unfinished business. You know, and like, these kind of collective action protests have been proven to work in Germany and in other places. And, you know, like, there is a result here that we're looking for, and hopefully we're going to get it.
Germany, of course, where season ticket prices and single match day prices are much, much lower. Obviously, we can't compare abroad. We have to compare within the Premier League. But it is worth noticing that actually football clubs, football organisations can put their fans first. There's nothing stopping them doing that, apart from perhaps greed.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that was one of the main things we were pushing as well. Like, as the fact that we've got the third most expensive ticket behind the goal in the whole of the Premier League. Like, talking about comparing to other teams in England, we got the third most, like ahead of, you know, ahead of, like, only behind Chelsea, Man City. So more expensive than Man U.
More expensive than Man U, more expensive than Arsenal, and it's all relative. More on the hashtag Stop the Greed protest when we come back.
This is Love Sport.
London calling, Fulham calling. It is the Fulham Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and Guy Barlow and George Singer from the Fulhamish podcast. Just a moment ago, we were hearing about the hashtag Stop the Greed protests on Saturday, and that is far from the end for the movement. So what's coming up next?
Like Guy said, this is just the beginning. So we mentioned before, you know, this isn't just a one-off piece. And I think one of the main reasons for that is when it comes to ticket pricing, you're never going to see an immediate impact. It's not like the club can suddenly lower tickets and you can see immediately that the ticket prices are going to go down. That's just not going to happen. This is something where we need to keep the pressure up. We need to keep telling the club that we're not happy to do this, because at the end of the day, they're going to make the decision over the summer about ticket prices going forward. You know, what should the baseline be for season tickets? What should the baseline be for match tickets? Obviously, with season tickets, they make that decision earlier, but with match tickets, you know, we need to keep that pressure on, and we need to keep telling the club that they need to think about both the short-term and long-term impact of keeping ticket prices high. So this is something we're going to have to keep pushing, and we're going to need that support from Fulham fans to make sure the club don't forget it. So in the very short term, banners should be coming along to Watford. So obviously we're at Vicarage Road tomorrow. We've got some plans to bring the banners along to there. So, you know, fingers crossed, we might be able to get those into the stadium. But whatever happens, even if we're not allowed to, we'll be definitely doing some pieces there to spread the word again. And then I think going forward, you know, we're having conversations about how we can keep the message going at games. And I think there's lots of different ways we can do that. I don't think it's going to be the case that we'll do a big protest at every game. But, you know, this is something where we need to keep the pressure on.
Yeah, and in many ways, the Man City game was a good opportunity for this protest. You know, it was on TV, and the coverage we got was very impressive in a way. You know, we did get a bit from Sky Sports. Drew's article mentions the iPaper, the Daily Mail, and the ESPN, all giving us, you know, coverage. So like the word is out there now. And especially if you've listened to Fulhamish or follow Fulhamish on various, you know, social media, website, whatever. And it's just about keeping it going. Like you said, Watford tomorrow night, it's not a sellout, I don't believe. So there might be some space for the banners to be on to be on permanent display. And, you know, George and I will be there tomorrow helping out Farrell, who was, you know, so important. As was everyone in Fulhamish as in this protest, you know. It wasn't perfect, but we're going to learn from it, and things are going to improve, and hope in terms of the way we protest, and things are going to improve hopefully in, you know, the way that the club is pricing their tickets so that more people can go to watch Fulham.
Absolutely. And I think it's worth mentioning, it wasn't just Fulhamish guys. We had a raft of volunteers as well, so we put the word out that we needed some help, you know, reaching out to people, you know, holding up banners, flying, leafleting, etc. And we had, you know, we had a small army of people there who came and helped out. You know, these are Fulham fans who, you know, for purely selfless reasons, you know, came early, got stuck in, you know, spread the message out, because, you know, it's not just something that Fulhamish care about, it's something that all Fulham fans care about.
Yeah, it is for the future. And I think that point that Drew made in his article on the Fulhamish website is that, you know, like, as you mentioned, he's about to become a father, and he wants to make, you know, sure that his children can go to games. And I think that's a point that resonates with, you know, particularly the older generation of Fulham fans. And, you know, it's a point that should resonate with everyone, really, the fact that we want to be enticing younger fans to the club, something we did so well in the Championship. We've spoken so much about how our fan base grew. If you look at our average attendances away in the Premier League, they're about 1,200, I think, and that didn't actually dip in the Championship. Like, we maintained that level, and that shows that, like, you know, we sold out multiple away games in the Championship. We've sold out multiple away games this year, and that's because partly because of the £30 price cap that we've been able to sell out so many away games. Which is, you know, I know that a lot of fans of other clubs might be like, oh, that's a given. You should be selling out every game, blah blah blah. But it's not a given for Fulham, and it's something we've done really well, and we brought a new generation of fans through, partly due to our success in the Championship, and it's something we just want to carry on, you know.
Absolutely, and I think if the club really do want to just think in money terms, any time they reduce the price, you're investing in fans. Like I mentioned before in my article I wrote about a week ago, you know, what really drove me to the club was those really cheap European tickets. And obviously, you know, Fulham aren't going to be in Europa League probably anytime soon, let's face it. But that was, for me, the club may have taken a small hit on their matchday revenue for that game, but they invested in me as a fan. And, you know, I wouldn't be as big a fan as I am now. I wouldn't be spending the amount of money on Fulham as I am now if they didn't invest on me back then.
And exactly, and it's one of the very few businesses in the world where once you've enticed someone in the first time, you're going to keep them, you know.
Unless you lose 5-0 the first time, in which case they'll never come back.
Yeah, but once they're in, you know, like that's the cliche, the adage, you know, supporters are for life, directors, players come and go, but supporters are going to stay there. And like you said, it's an investment.
Absolutely. And I think, yeah,
there is monetary value in fans as well. Like, you know, if you're there, George, and you turn up every week, if the tickets are 10 quid cheaper, but you go every week as a result, long term, there's money there. There's success on the pitch from the 12th man point of view. There is all sorts of things to be gained by having your supporters turn up. We are underway. Arsenal versus Newcastle at the Emirates. About 8 minutes in, Arsenal looking quite tidy, it has to be said. Lacazette and Iwobi looking very, very busy at the top end of the pitch. Not just creatively on the ball, but also winning it back when they lose it. So we'll be bringing you updates from that game as we get them. I just want to touch on this situation with Luca Murphy, which is very complex. This guy who was at Hartlepool. Hartlepool have come out and said they're going to vigorously seek compensation for Fulham, which presumably means repeatedly tugging on their arm until they get some money, for compensation for teenager Luca Murphy. The complicated thing here is Murphy was actually released by Hartlepool after a potential January move to Fulham fell through. The 17-year-old has now joined Fulham. He joined on Friday. So Hartlepool are claiming they were presented with a list of reasons why Murphy, in their words, wasn't good enough to join Fulham. And they're effectively implying with the phrase his behaviour deteriorated, that his head got turned and he started misbehaving. Should Fulham just get this kid for free? Is compensation? Are Hartlepool whining? What's going on?
Well, firstly, if what Hartlepool are claiming is true, it's pretty woeful from Fulham, and you know, shouldn't be condemned because, like, I don't know, the way that it seems to have gone down is that, like you said, it has been turned. We did the old, you know, bait and switch. We don't want him, we do want him.
The old bait and switch.
Yeah, that seems to have what's worked out. And I guess it says a lot about, you know, if you want to extrapolate it, it says a lot about the way that agents work in football. And, you know, there weren't any agents named directly in the Hartlepool statement, but they were heavily implied. And
do you think that Fulham, and obviously I'm sure the club are blameless and would deny any allegation, and I for one am absolutely not alleging anything, but is there any part of you that thinks that Fulham might have, as the old cliche goes, tapped this kid up and had a word and said, listen, we want you, we've agreed this fee, it's a bit more than we're willing to pay, we're going to say you're not good enough, you're going to basically get yourself released,
and then you can come to Fulham.
Could that have been going on?
Maybe.
That's what Hollywood are claiming, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean,
they're not claiming that exactly because they can't do so in such specific terms, but they are implying it.
Yeah. And firstly, I think it's kind of, there's some sweet irony there of it was the weekend when we were really pushing the Stop the Greed piece where it looked like the club were doing everything they could to avoid paying compensation, which
for a 17-year-old centre-back from Hartlepool.
Yeah, which for the grand scheme of things for Fulham would be very small and Hartlepool would be very large because obviously...
Non-league now.
Yeah, and famously all the money issues they'd had previously, they're now in a slightly more stable position. They could have really done with that money. The timeline, which has been, you know, all I've read on this is what was on the Hartlepool website, and the timeline which they're laying out was they had a player who was their player, Fulham proposed interest, said they didn't want him, the player gets his head turned, stop playing, leaves the club, and Fulham get him for free. there's always so much that goes on behind the scenes. You know, it could
sounds like a year 12 relationship, doesn't it? I like him now. I don't like him. Swipe right, then swipe left. Hard to get from Fulham.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say something. I mean, obviously, it seems like a serious issue, but way back in January, when Cam Ramsey of this pods and show, we were talking about transfer windows. He wrote some great pieces during the transfer window, and he brought up Luca Murphy. And me and Dom absolutely ripped into him for bringing up a rumour about a 17-year-old centre-back from Hartlepool. We were like, who cares? We're about to be relegated. Give us some meat. You know, like, what is going on? And he also mispronounced Hartlepool somehow.
What did he say?
He said Hartlepool.
Hartlepool. I quite like that, Hartlepool.
So that's just a funny little throwback. It's come back to bite a...
Goal to Arsenal. It is Arsenal. No, it's not. It's in the back of the net. Aaron Ramsey arriving at the back post with a really, really cool half-volley finish just into the bottom right corner of Martin Dubravka's net. But it has been immediately chalked out by the referee. No hesitation at all. Arsenal are outraged. The ball comes into the back post. It's flicked on by Kolasinac. And I think...
I think the
allegation must be that there is pushing... on that Sokratis is pushing his marker over. That looks very, very soft. The arm is up slightly from Sokratis, but really, not sure.
Yeah, and with decisions like that, I think, has it been made official today that the Championship isn't going to get VAR next season, even though...
Quite right, too.
Guy Barlow is having none of this.
Thank goodness for that.
Apparently you're not a fan?
No.
Why not?
Because it slows down the game and it helps bring
the right decision.
Yeah, well,
could have been a goal.
If you were an Arsenal fan in that context, I have seen one replay and my instinct is that it's a bit soft. Would it not help for the referee to be able to have another look at that?
No, they're all subjective. Like, just leave it to what the referee decides. At the end of the day, even if he has had 1,000 look at it, it's still going to be his personal decision and we can't influence that. And, like, the rules aren't fit for purpose. There are so many reasons. It makes it a different sport. There are so many reasons why I hate VAR and why I'm so happy it's not come to the Championship.
We're hearing that the referee actually blew for a foul before the ball even hit the back of the net. So he wouldn't have needed a second look because he was sure. And Guy Barlow is, as ever, completely right. As a final note on Luca Murphy, you said you were all laughing at Cam Ramsey of this good parish when he brought up the potential of the signing. Do you think he's any good? Or is this just an
future
argument?
Future club captain, I'm sure.
Okay, so worth the potential legal ramifications. George, what do you reckon?
I've got no idea. I've never seen this guy. Look, I mean, there's clearly something about him. My main concern at this point would be if he did have his head turned previously and we could turn his head, you know, what's to stop that happening again? You know, it's always hard to make judgment without really knowing what's happening. We've only heard one side of the story. You know, maybe we'll hear stuff from the player going forward or the agent, or I think it's unlikely Fulham will say anything at all, but that would be my only concern. Obviously, he's young. There's clearly something about him, so want to keep an eye on going forward.
Yeah, our academy's great, to be honest. Like, we don't need to expand on it much more than that. I think if Hugh Jennings has spotted something he likes, then I'm all for trusting his judgment, and I'm sure he'll be knocking on the first team hopefully soon.
Yeah, well, regardless of what happens in the courts, should it go that far, Luca Murphy is a Fulham player and we will be watching his development with interest. Coming up, the gents sitting here with me seem to have accepted a Fulham relegation this season, so we'll be looking back on previous Fulham relegations, just in case one wasn't enough.
This is Love Sport.
The VAR debate is raging in this studio. It's not what we're going to talk on now, but it shows the way that it just divides fans. Guy Barlow's shaking his head. He's speechless with George Singer, who is grinning cheekily.
I love VAR. It's brilliant. It's just pure chaos.
I thought it was supposed
it's
to
entertainment.
Make,
it's what football's
I thought
all about.
It was supposed to take away debate. Like I thought it was supposed to make everything black and white, but no.
So, George, you're actively looking for more chaos here.
Absolutely. That's what we all loved. Right, the World Cup was one of the greatest World Cups there's been. Right?
But you've said the word World Cup there. I only need to give you one goal. Frank Lampard versus Germany. Uruguayan ref, who I'm sure was doing his best and wasn't cheating, but I'm still outraged. If we have VAR...
I'm fine with going on technology. Give me an example where, like, there's an off... Like, Maradona's hand of God is a better example.
Okay, Maradona's hand of God. It's an outrage.
But again, like, these things, it's football. Like, I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about how, like, is football like physics or is it art? Like,
Jean Paul Sartre suddenly walked into the studio.
Like, how do you like it? For me, it's just, I don't know. Like, just let it be. Let it be. It's the most popular sport in the world for a reason, because it's so simple and so brilliant. You don't need to fill it technology. Go on technology, I'm fine with. Yeah, whatever. But the offside rule isn't fit for purpose as it stands with VAR. So you need to change the offside rule, even though it's working fine without VAR.
Change handball as well.
Change the handball rule. Like, change the push in the back law. Because we saw that goal disallowed in the Champions League, Morata on Chiellini, which turned out to be crucial in the end, didn't it? I don't know. VAR's rubbish.
All change for Fulhamish and no VAR. Looking specifically at Fulham, the current Premier League table does not make for happy reading. 17 points from 32 games, 16 points clear of safety. I say clear, I mean not safe. It's looking like relegation. And with that in mind, gentlemen, I'd like to offer you an opportunity to reminisce on previous games that have seen Fulham drop a division.
So, I guess to be clear, tomorrow's match, if we lose, we're mathematically relegated. I think if we draw, effectively relegated because our goal difference is so poor. So we'd need to win to still have a chance to stay in the league. So considering how poor our away record is, considering we haven't won a single game away at home yet this season, it looks pretty likely that this is going to be the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah, definitely. So the game that I had in mind when this came up in the running order was obviously the last official game, which was Stoke away. We lost 4-1. Magats Fulham.
Magats Fulham.
I'm going to run through the Fulham team, and I'm sure George will shudder at some of these names. Stockdale, 5 at the back of Byrne at right back.
Right back?
6'7", left-footed Dan Byrne at right back. John Alarisa, hate him. Heisinger, Hangerland, and Diarra at centre back.
Which Diarra?
Mamadou
Diarra.
And then in midfield, we had Holtby, who was substituted after 34 minutes. Parker, Sidwell, Bent, and Richardson. Oh. What a terrible team. No wonder we got relegated.
Compared to the team now, because I feel at least there are players in this current team who you guys do actually look at with fondness, and there isn't anyone in that team really who you've read down that list and gone, oh, him.
Ask us in 5 years, I think, because that team is better than this one. Statistically, it is. Yeah, well, they got 9 wins. We only got 4.
Yeah, I think,
and they won away from home.
Yeah,
they got more than 2 away points.
To be fair, the league is much tougher now. The general quality of teams around us is much better, but that is a shocking team. Oh, and the Dan Byrne at right back is the one that we all look back at. He's a huge, lanky guy. Didn't he sign for Brighton, but he's back on loan at Wigan?
No, he was loaned back to Wigan, but now he's back at Brighton.
Is he back at Brighton now? Yeah. So he's a lanky centre back, had one of the games of his life against Man United that season. Where
he didn't have the game of his life.
He headed away like
it was the record for the most crosses. And he just headed it away with his big head. He's like 6'7". Of course, he's going
to
head it.
Well,
away.
I'd like to speak as someone who's 6'5" and plays centre half and has never won a header in his life. That just being tall doesn't mean you will win the headers.
He was rubbish. He was rubbish for us in the Championship. He was rubbish for us at right back against Osayidi. And I don't know.
I did, this wasn't meant to depress you guys.
No, it is in hindsight, it's quite funny. Like, because we were 3-0 down, and then, you know, Jonathan Walter scored, Osayidi, Arnautovic.
There's some proper banter names in there,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, it's who's who of Pulis' Stoke, isn't it? And I don't know, like, that Dan Byrne at right back, honestly.
It was the thing that summed up Magath's tenure at Fulham so much. We called it, we've had Slav Bingo before. It all started with Felix Bingo, where every game he'd put random players in. That was the first time we saw Corley Woodrow. Scorley Woodrow and Kostas Mitroglou.
He came
to be on, fair, he should have been a good signing.
He came on in that game. You know, he's probably one of the only record signings ever in history never to play a home game for the club he became the record signing for.
It's a good stat, that.
And he came on in that game, was absolutely useless.
I will never forget Cheddargate. That, for me, is the ultimate Magat moment.
Yeah, and no, I like the one where he made them stand in formation for 45 minutes after they...
What was it? If you're going to be statues on the pitch, you're going to be statues in training too. Was that the line?
Something like that, yeah.
And then the club decided he would be the right man to get us promoted out the Championship. So, yeah, thanks.
Well,
for that.
An authoritarian, if nothing else. Were there any other relegations that stick out for you?
I think that was probably the only one. I think we got relegated just before I was born into the old fourth tier away at Swansea.
An illustrious beginning to your life as a Fulham fan.
Yes. And then we were close to relegation that first season, 95-96. Because remember, we were second bottom at Christmas that year, I believe. And then
I like that we're defining first season and Fulham's existence as post the birth of Guy Barlow, in some sort of messianic way.
Post GB. but that's the only... Yeah, I mean, I'm very lucky compared to most Fulham fans. That is the only relegation I remember. Is it worse because it's the first one? Maybe, but yeah, I don't know.
I think so, and I think for people like me and so many others who grew up only ever knowing Fulham in the Premier League, that's what all of us were used to, and it was a real shock going down to the Championship because it was completely new to us. And I think, to be honest, you know, I think so many Fulham fans are actually, in a strange way, really excited to go back to the Championship. There's going to be more games. We're going to win more of the ball. You know, the Premier League really, I'm going to sound pretty bitter here, but the Premier League really isn't all it's cracked up
exactly
to be.
And it's not the be-all and end-all. Like, there's no shame in being a Championship club, you know?
No.
And if anything, that's what our size of club is, you know? And if you want to even draw it out to history, like, we've got no, you know, Preston, we won the Premier League for 13 years, but before that was by far our longest ever stint in the top flight. And, you know, I'd be perfectly happy being a yo-yo team going up. Because winning games, you know, it's so stupid to say, but it's fun. Like, you want to go to the Championship and remember what it's like to win. We lost 10 in a row.
Well, Guy, you could have your wish soon. It could happen in even the next week or so. And coming up, should Fulham go down, we'll be looking at which players they should be looking to keep in the Championship.
This is Love Sport.
Fulham could be a Championship side before long. It's sounding like that would be good news as far as Guy Barlow of Fulhamish is concerned. But should the side go down, who of this current squad, and I think let's talk realistically, so not perhaps the Alexander Mitrovic of this world, who should Fulham be holding on to?
Well, we should clarify, I wasn't coming into the season hoping to be relegated.
No, of course, but you recognise the genuine delights that there can be of Championship football.
Yeah, I recognise the negatives as well, but it's only relegation at the end of the day. The club isn't folding. You know, there are lots of clubs in far worse positions than we are. So I think just maybe a bit of perspective on that front would be key. But anyway, players who we're going to keep, we're probably going to have Bettinelli back. He's got a long-term contract, so he'll definitely be our starting goalkeeper next year. I think Ream and Odoi might have contracts running out, so we're going to see what's going to happen with them. We'll definitely have Joe Bryan, who's a good Championship player. Sambo's going to stick around, I'm sure. I saw rumours that the club are desperate to keep Seri next year, but if that happens, we don't know. And
he would look quite tidy at Championship level, wouldn't he?
I think more than tidy.
I think veritably clean.
Yeah, I think he'd be probably the best player in the division. But, you know, I guess the only question marks are, apart from the contract situations, are Sess and Kenny, I'd say.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think from my point of view, there's a couple of players who we will be happy to see leave the club, and Andre Schürrle is probably number one on that list for me.
I'd drive him back myself.
He's hands down been the most disappointing signing, I think, from his pedigree of what he'd done,
this season.
World Cup.
He's a
winning
winner,
goal assister. I don't know. Is that the best way of saying
that's
it?
That's the thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. He's been very poor. I think we're resigned to losing some of the big guys. I think the issue with if we did keep a player like Seri, whilst we might have a relegation clause in his contract, he's going to be on a lot of money, and that really puts pressure on the club. If we do go down with him, we're going to need to get promoted straight away, because we saw it last time. I remember our first season back in the Championship, we had Brian Ruiz, we had Hugo Rodallega, we had these, like, you know, incredible players.
Huge earnings as well.
Huge earnings.
But Parker was one of
Scott
them, actually.
Parker.
Yeah.
And we were so front heavy, and all of our resources were put in those guys. and the rest of the team was pretty poor. I remember our defence being kind of Kay Vosa, Tim Hoogland.
Top scorer Tim Hoogland.
Yeah, I mean, some really average players there. And it really put the pressure on the club because we didn't bounce back straight away and we were in a really poor position. So I think we need to be realistic about losing a few of those. But from my point of view, if I could keep one of the current crop, it would be Zambo. I think he's just a cut above the rest of the midfielders that we've got. He's such a unique player in that he's not only a destroyer, he can win the ball and, you know, take the ball off opposition players with ease. But he's also an incredible dribbler. Like a few of the times against City,
yeah. He
took the ball into the corner. You know,
goal,
he's so
George. I'm sorry, but Aaron Ramsey was denied by the referee's whistle the first time around, not to be the second. I'm delighted to see the glum face of our producer Laurie Callis, who is of course a Newcastle fan through the glass. It's a fantastic finish from Ramsey. And just before the game kicked off, just before the show began, it was asked, I think, by Guy Barlow why, or indeed perhaps by George Singer, why Arsenal are still playing Ramsey, given he's off in the summer. Well, that is why. A really tidy flick on to Lacazette. He picks the ball up again on the edge of the box.
It's ricocheted to him.
Fine, it's ricocheted to him, but he slots it very, very nicely off the inside of the far post. It's a fluke. VAR's rubbish. Fulham are going down. I hate the world, but it is Arsenal 1, Newcastle 0. George, I apologise. Carry on.
That's all right. No, it reminds me a little bit of the Ramsey goal against Fulham, which was one of the best goals I've ever seen anyone score. The Arsenal
bit less neat than that, but
a little bit. But you saw how direct and, you know, his ability to just flick it on to other people. He's a great player. I think Juventus will be much stronger with him next season. But yeah, Zambo and Gisa. If I could keep one of the current crop, it would be him. I think he'd give this, you know, real strong platform. We mentioned before about how integral Kev McDonald was. Of, you know, he was at the central of midfield, that hub. He would always be there, who'd be the ball just stuck to him and everything could come off, and you know, he attacks would come from his base of possession. I think in a similar way Anguissa would be able to destroy oppositions and start attacks himself, you know.
Yeah, I don't know, there might be something to be said for actually getting in quite a lot of new blood next year. I mean, at the beginning of this year, obviously, we had too much. So there is a balance to be found there. But I think that when you play this badly for so long, you know, that there is a hangover. And we've seen it with so many teams. Like, it's, you need some new players to come in there and inject a bit of life. And I know Fulham have been reluctant to sign from other rival championship clubs and even lower league clubs. But I think some players who are just hungry to get out of the division and know what it's about is really important for us, because we saw how much Fulham had a hangover after we lost in the playoffs. We didn't get going on our promotion season until January, and then we went on an unbeaten run. Villa have had it this year. They lost in the playoff final to us, obviously, and they've only just started getting going now, and it's like March, April. So, and obviously Sunderland had back-to-back relegations. So, like, when you play so badly for so long, it's so hard. Just like winning is a habit, losing is a habit, and we're in a habit of losing. And we need to break that habit with, I think, a few new players.
Absolutely. New blood could be the answer for Fulham should they go down to the Championship. But there is still Premier League football to be played, starting, of course, with Watford tomorrow. And in just a moment, we'll be talking to Jacob Colshaw, who is a contributor to 90min.com and a Watford fan, to get the opposition view.
This is Love Sport.
Fitting that we should have heard from the Watford fan show just a moment ago, because it is Watford next for Fulham in the Premier League. And I'm delighted to say that we're joined on the line by Jacob Colshaw, who's a contributor to 90min.com and a Watford fan, to give the opposition view of the fixture. Evening, Jacob. Thanks ever so much for joining us. Are you confident looking ahead at this game?
Yeah, I'm very confident for tomorrow. Probably slightly overconfident considering Fulham's really poor run at the moment. But then we can maybe slip up, and that's probably the one thing in the back of my mind that I'm thinking about. With Fulham's poor run, they need to win to stay up, obviously, if Burnley get the result on Wednesday. So it's going to be really interesting. It's going to be an interesting one. Fulham are fighting for their lives. Watford have got the game on Sunday to look forward to as well. So I think the big thing going into this game is, who is Javi Gracia going to be playing? Is he going to rest the squad, thinking we've got a good enough team to go out there and beat Fulham? or is he going to play the strongest 11 possible and just get the job done? It's going to be really interesting to see which lineup Habib goes for, but no, I do expect Watford to get the win.
Yeah, I think that's the point I was going to ask about. Like, obviously, the game on Sunday is so big, like FA Cup semi-final. What Fulham fans would give to be in that position, you know? I think regardless of the lineup, even if you do play a strongest team, surely they're all going to have a half an eye on it. You know, like, you can't change the player's mentality in that sense, can you?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point because obviously, as you mentioned, it's a massive game this coming Sunday. And the last thing you want to be doing is pulling up, getting an injury ahead of that one, and ruling yourself out of it. And to be honest, we've got a pretty deep squad at the moment. We have got a number of players in a number of positions that can come in and do a job. But I think in the back of Javi's mind, he'll be thinking semi-final is the priority. Of course, we want to be getting 3 points against Fulham tomorrow, but he's going to be thinking, what team can I put out there that is good enough to beat Fulham, but also at the same time have one eye on the FA Cup semi-final, because that is an absolutely huge game for the football club.
Yeah, obviously it's been a really strong season for Watford, and you find yourself, you know, there's 4 clubs separated by a point or something, aiming for seventh place. I mean, as a fan, does that seventh place, obviously, you know, hopefully you'd rather get European football by winning the FA Cup, but is the seventh place, you know, really a big draw for you? Is that something that you're really passionate about as a fan?
Yeah, of course. I think it's kind of been a debate going around in the Watford fan base at the moment. Would you take an FA Cup final but lose in the final, or finish seventh in the league? And I'm certainly of the opinion that I'd finish seventh out of the two. Of course, it'd be great to have a day out of Wembley. But at the same time, to have a European tour following your club abroad is just something that you don't get to do often. I know Fulham did that in the Europa League, is it almost a decade ago now?
A leg in there, didn't you, Jacob? You were being so nice, then you thought, no, have a bit of that.
That's really depressing.
Honestly, I'm jealous that I haven't had the experience to go abroad and follow my football club. So to get that opportunity would be brilliant. It's going to be tight between Wolves, Everton, and West Ham probably just dropping away now, but I think Wolves, Watford and Everton are the 3 teams that are eyeing up that seventh Europa League spot. But again, it's still important tomorrow's game, because we're still on the hunt for Europa League. We don't want to let that slip. But at the same time, it's a really tough balancing act with the game coming up on Sunday.
Is there a concern there for you, Jacob, about that seventh place spot? It's something I've been discussing a lot with the lads from West Ham World on the West Ham fan show, that actually we have seen it many times before. We saw it with Burnley most recently, where the added fixture congestion that the Europa League leads to, particularly in the first few weeks of the season, can actually derail your domestic form. Is that something that bothers you, or are you just so excited about seeing Watford in Europe?
No, it doesn't bother me. I think the difference between, say, Watford, if they got into the Europa League this season, and Burnley, is I feel like we have a better squad than Burnley if we did get into the Europa League. And I also feel like the Potsos and then Scott Duxbury would act on it, and they'd invest and get an even stronger squad. So when we do go into the Europa League qualifiers, if we do, that we've got a good enough squad to compete, and we've got a good enough squad to deal with the fixture congestion. I think that's obviously going to be a big priority. I think the issue Burnley had is they haven't got a big squad anyway, and then to have that with the extra fixtures, playing in midweek and everything that comes with it, they couldn't deal with it, and that's why they've struggled in the league this season, I think, as well. But I think you've got to embrace it. It doesn't come around a lot. If it does happen, obviously Wolves, Leicester and Everton and West Ham are still in it. It's all fine for that spot, but no, I'd be really excited for it and definitely embrace it.
And tactically, I mean, I haven't watched that much of Watford this season. I was at the home home match earlier in the season. But I mean, is it like a pretty simple 4-4-2 for you guys? I want to follow up with something. Obviously, Wolves have been getting most of the plaudits this season in that seventh place race. I don't know. Like, do you think you guys deserve more in terms of coverage and in the press?
Yeah, well, in answer to your first question with the tactics, we set up with a 4-4-2, kind of inverted wingers who play as 2 attacking midfielders who drop into the middle. Very compact defensively, quite a narrow formation. What you're seeing up front with Troy Deeney and Deulofeu, who's kind of been converted into a striker, is that little man, big man partnership. Deeney's normally the one either to knock it on or hold up the ball and play Deulofeu in. But we've also got the creativity of Pereira and Hughes, and then the 2 midfielders who are so crucial to Javi's system of Etienne Capoue and Abdoulaye Doucouré. And those two have been absolutely fantastic this season. And it kind of links into to your second question regarding whether we aren't getting enough plaudits this season. I think, yeah, we aren't really, because obviously it's been phenomenal from Wolves. Obviously, the amount of money they have invested this season is a part to play in it. But to come up from the Championship and deal so well with the Premier League, they've been fantastic. But at the same time, I don't think Javi Gracia and Watford are getting enough plaudits in terms of eighth in the Premier League, semi-finals of the FA Cup. It's been a brilliant season for Watford, and I think most people are writing us off before the start of the season, especially towards the bottom end of the table, particularly how we dropped off midway through last season. So I think, yeah, in answer to your second question, there haven't been enough plaudits for Watford, really. But at the same time, I like being under the radar, and I like pundits not really rating us too much, because it keeps us under the radar and it keeps us performing well. And we've been doing really well recently, and most of our losses have come against the top six. So overall, it's been a fantastic season. But yeah, I think some people don't give us the credit we deserve.
This will be my first time going to Vicarage Road as a football fan. I went a couple of times when I was younger to go watch Saracens when you used to do the ground share with them. What can we expect from a ground point of view? You know, what do you think the atmosphere will be like? Obviously, it's an evening kickoff, so do you think the atmosphere is going to be quite good?
Well, I think, especially with the game leading up to Wembley, it should be a pretty good atmosphere. In terms of a Fulham's fan perspective, you get a pretty good allocation at Watford. I think it's 2,500. It's half of a stand given up to the away fans. So, yeah, it's a really nice ground for away fans. Good view as well. But no, it should be a decent atmosphere. Obviously, the game leading up to Wembley. But no, I think what you'll notice is as a Fulham fan, it would have been interesting if you had been before in the earlier days, is we've got a whole new stand, the Elton John stand on the left-hand side, and there's a lot of redevelopment at Watford, which if you'd say 10 years ago, you wouldn't have been seeing. You would have seen three stands, pretty tacky, but now we look like a real football club. So, yeah, the owners we have to be thankful for the owners for that.
Yeah, you mentioned Will Hughes. I mean, we watched him a fair few seasons in a row in the Championship, and he was always on the cusp of making the step up. It'd be interesting to know from someone who's watching him week in, week out, what you think of him. Like, is he Premier League class quality now?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point regarding Will Hughes. He was always on the cusp of a big move. I remember Liverpool were linked with a £5 million move a while back, and no one really took the chance on him. And it was only because Gary Rowett didn't play Will Hughes in Derby setup that he had to leave. And Watford identified him as someone who has real ability. He's got brilliant first touch. Plays a lot of first-time passes. Maybe one element of his game that he could add to is goals. He doesn't score enough goals for me. And I think if he did so and got more assists and got more goals, he'd be in Gareth Southgate's, in contention for the England squad. I think he's a player who has real ability, and obviously he'd worked with Southgate in the under-21 setup as well. So he's someone who has real ability. He's been brilliant for Watford this season. And again, he's fundamental to Gracia's system. He's a right midfielder that kind of drifts inside. He works really hard defensively as well, and he adds a bit of creativity. And that final ball is what we lack at times, and he provides that. So no, he's been another player. He's been fantastic for us this season. But what kind of gets missed is his work rate off the ball. He does provide creativity on it, but off the ball as well, he does his bit defensively, and that's the brilliant part of Will Hughes.
You mentioned what Vicarage Road used to be like. I mean, I think the last time we played in the Premier League must have been in the mid-noughties. Was it 3-3? When you had Ashley Young,
I think it was the 06,
and it was on TV. I remember it was a Monday night game, and it was 3-3. I think we were 3-1 up, and you came back, and that was when like we couldn't win away from home to I don't know for anything. But those are happier times for you, and that was, I think you got relegated that season. So roles are reversed, I guess. We were happily mid table back then.
Yeah, no, that season was very depressing. It was under Adi Boothroyd, and I remember that game actually. It was probably one of the better games of the season. Ashley Young scoring with a overhead kick in the last minute, I believe.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that was a really poor season actually. We finished with a really low points tally. But no, the way we're coping with the Premier League now is a lot different to how we were back then.
Back when Ashley Young was actually allowed to attack. Jacob, it's been lovely speaking to you, but I'm going to have to put you on the spot before we let you get going, I'm afraid. What's the score going to be, mate?
I'm going to go for a confident 3-1 Watford.
He's a confident man. He's just become a less popular man in the studio.
An accurate man.
Although there are, I was about to say, there are resigned and nodding heads around me. Jacob, thanks ever so much. Jacob Colshaw there. Colshaw, sorry, who is contributor to 90min.com and also a Watford fan. Coming up, we'll be getting the Fulham view of the game.
This is Love Sport.
You are listening to the Fulham Fan Show here on Love Sport Radio with me, Johnny Burrow, and George Singer and Guy Barlow from the Fulhamish podcast. It's half time in Arsenal Newcastle. The score is Arsenal 1, Newcastle 0. But just before half time, we saw one of the most extraordinary pieces of defending from Matt Ritchie, of all people. One of the most extraordinary pieces of defending you will ever see. Kolasinac plays a lovely ball into the box. Lacazette turns sharply and fires beyond Dubravka. And Ritchie is there to head it off the line. And Kolasinac is in my fantasy team, so now I'm sulking. But to more important matters, and Fulham Watford tomorrow. We heard Jacob Colshaw's view, a confident view. It has to be said that it's going to be a Watford 3-1 win. Looking at that Watford team, who in it really stands out to you as a threat?
Yeah, I think he's got every right to be confident. I think one of the
I love the positivity of the Fulham fan show. I say it every week. Last week it was, I hope we get battered by City so Liverpool don't win the league. And this year it's
not that bad this week.
No, it's true. It's just Watford are better than us and we should be terrified.
Yeah, yeah. It's just glass half full stuff. No, I think one of the things looking at Watford, really direct side with really... very physical strikers. So the little and large, if they go with the Deeney and Deulofeu. I remember looking back at when we played against Bournemouth at home, kind of earlier in the season. I think it was one of Slavisa's last games. It was a really poor result. And I remember doing a preview article for that. And one of the main concerns I had about that match was just how direct Bournemouth were. And how much Fulham struggle against direct sides. Against those sides, you'd run quick at us and you'd pass the ball quickly through us. We really struggle with that really soft underbelly we've got. And, you know, I 100% see that Watford are going to do the same thing to us. I think it's going to be a really long afternoon for those of us who are going up there from a Fulham point of view. The obvious choice for the one to watch out is probably Troy Deeney. You know, he's... For so many years now, he's just been that giant, real kind of thug of a man who can just push any player off the ball. He can win any duel. He can win any header. And he's just got that knack of being in the right place at the right time. And we've seen it so many times. And we will, you know, for many years going forward, I'm sure, just his ability to just be right place, right time, and just stick the ball in the back of the net. And that's one thing that we've, you know, really been struggling without ourselves this season.
Yeah, I've just been looking at the stats and shaking my head. I mean, obviously stats aren't everything, but you know, like we haven't won Watford in I was not about expected goals there, George. Don't worry. I was talking about like you know more. I don't know. I'm I'll probably say the wrong thing. So I'm just gonna carry on. We haven't beaten them in 5 games. It's just these quite funny ones. Like our 2 points away from home is the lowest in the top 4 tiers of English football. Love that. That is great. conceded. I like this one as well. I mentioned this one last week. We did it again against Man City. Conceded twice in a row for the 12th consecutive game.
It's consistency.
Yeah,
you've got to give credit where it's due. It's consistency.
I don't know. We kept one clean sheet away from home this season away at Newcastle. So. But yeah, overall,
our producer,
George,
by the way, our Newcastle supporting producer, is taking an absolute battering this evening.
Yeah, and yeah, that is honestly shameful. The fact that one, the fact that not only Fulham got an away point,
he's in tears.
Yeah, and we get the clean sheet. That is embarrassing.
He's actually just walked out.
Yeah. I think in terms of the actual playing of the match, I think we've got a. I don't know. It's a sad state of affairs. It's like we're an FA Cup team going away to a Premier League club. You know, it's like we just got to hope to hit them on the break or get lucky to get a result. Because as you said, our underbelly is so soft. Like any kind of, you know, direct play on any kind of quality, and I feel like you're worried that they're going to get through. And I think it'd be sad to see us relegated tomorrow. Obviously, all joking aside, but I think. It just has to be done now. Just get it over with.
Yeah, I agree. From a fan point of view, you just kind of want to... Yeah, you just want it to kind of be all over in some way, so you can kind of get rid of that false hope. I think what's going to be really interesting is seeing how Parker wants to set up, because obviously against Man City, who are very, very particular, you know, they play a very particular style of football. Parker changed his tactics accordingly. Now, whether that was the right thing to do or not, we discussed that earlier. I think as Watford are a very different kind of side, it's going to be really interesting to see how he lines up. You know, will he keep that third centre-back in there to maybe negate the, you know, the prowess of someone like Troy Deeney? You know, would it be more sensible for us to maybe look at man-marking him? So someone like Chambers in more of a free defensive role, you know, could we see that kind of thing? I think as Jacob called in earlier, the wide forward to push up and go more central and, you know, rather than hugging the touchline, almost come at those like kind of a two number 10 roles almost. You know, the place where we're going to be able to hit them is out wide. So it's going to be really interesting to see who we play out wide. You know, will we see Cesc come back? And then spearheading the attack, we're going to need... You know, we looked so lost without Mitrovic last against Man City. Reading the latest press conference from Parker, I think it looks touch and go. Apparently, Mitrovic has had quite a fairly lengthy injury, and international duty with Serbia kind of pushed him over the edge a little bit. So I think there's maybe a chance he'll be in there. And I think if we realistically want to get anything out of the match, we really need him back up front and firing on all cylinders.
Yeah, and we were saying this under Ranieri and we're now saying it under Parker. We just need to go back to what the players know best, which is, for me, 4-3-3. As you said, George, get the width. And if you look at some of our more encouraging... This is so depressing. Our more encouraging halves of football this season. So I'm thinking away at Arsenal, the first half, where Cesc missed two sitters and we should have been 2-0 up at half-time. Both those goals came from... one came from a cross out wide and one came from a pass with Cesc coming inverting in off the right wing and he missed. So I think we've got to go back to that and get those... just play football the way we've been playing for the past 2 years and just try and, you know, negate their physical threat and get in behind with using some pace like Cesc. And hopefully Mitrovic will be there to hold it up. But yeah, for me, just... 4-4-3.
It would help if you could have an extra player. That generally does make it easier.
4-3-3, yeah. yeah, I don't know. It almost feels futile talking about these kind of points at this stage of the season, considering the position we're in, you know, because if anything was going to happen, it, you know, would have happened and we'd be in a better position. You know, the oldest cliche is like, you deserve where to be, the league table doesn't lie, and it's true. And I don't know. I think what I just want to see is just... I'm looking just for moments now, between now and the end of the season, that are going to like give me a bit of... One, hope for the future, and two, something to look back on, you know? Just a bit of joy. I mean, Brighton at home, beating them 4-2 was great. Because now we can always look back on that seat on this season and be like, yeah, we came from 2-0 down for the first time in over 10 years and beat someone. And it was a home, it was a night game, it was fantastic, that game. But I think now, between now and the end of the season, I'd like to see us get a point away from home, either at Watford, Bournemouth, or
what about
Wolves.
3 points away from home?
Well, get 3 draws, I'll take that, yeah. but yeah, I'd like to see us win one of our remaining home games and get some points away from home. And, you know, wherever that ends up, you know, relegation is inevitable, but wherever that puts us, you know, mentally is more important at this point.
Yeah, I think our only probably saving grace of the match is that FA Cup game. Watford are carrying a couple of injuries with some people like Tom Cleverley, who's been out a little bit. Now, they don't have the kind of deepest squad in the world. They don't have the ability like Man City did to bring someone like Riyad Mahrez off the bench. You know, you can't really blame the players for having, you know, more than one eye, probably two eyes on the FA Cup game at the weekend. So I think the only chance we've really got is if Scott Parker can do a job of galvanizing the players, you know, bringing that passion back and a horrible cliche of wanting it more. I think if Parker can rally the troops in that way, that's probably the best way of us being able to maybe get the first away win of the season.
Definitely. I'm really hopeful of that.
Well, guys, it's that point in the show where I have to start asking you for your score prediction. So, George, we'll start with you. How's it going to go?
Oh, my heart says 1-0. My head says 2-1 loss.
2-1 loss.
The past 4 weeks, like all the score predictions have been jokey. We've been playing like top six teams. But this one, we've actually got a chance. So it's been more depressing.
Well, oh, God.
It's a bit more depressing when I'm going to say 3-1 Watford.
3-1 Watford. Join us next week on the Fulham Fan Show, where we will all be weeping into each other's shoulders.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from Love Sport Radio. For more, go to lovesportradio.com for all the latest podcasts, news and views. Or for more, follow us at Love Sport Radio on Twitter.